Good evening. Welcome back to the Fitzgerald Theater in downtown St. Paul. I'm Gary Eichten. Tonight we're broadcasting the last debate before Tuesday's primary election. The last debate featuring all four of the major candidates for the DFL U.S. Senate nomination. Polls have indicated a fair number of people who plan to vote in the DFL primary still haven't decided which candidate to support. And if you're one of those folks, we're hoping that tonight's debate will help you make up your mind. If you aren't planning to vote in the DFL primary, this could be a great opportunity to scout the opposition. The winner of Tuesday's primary goes on to the November general election against incumbent Republican Rod Grams. The other candidates will be eliminated from the race. Now, just a reminder, you can actually watch this debate on our website, minnesotapublicradio.org. There is a wealth of information about the campaign on our website. You can take the candidates' quiz, matching your positions on the issues with the candidates' positions. And tonight you can also send in questions for the candidates, minnesotapublicradio.org. Those of you here in our theater audience, again, a reminder, our Oprah is standing by. We're going to try to get to some more questions this hour. Maybe we can keep the answers a little shorter, candidates. Can we keep the answers a little shorter this hour? Good. Now, to begin this hour, a question for each of the candidates. Senator Grams and Senator Paul Wellstone are portrayed by us media jackals as being polar opposites. And in fact, their votes in the Senate often do cancel each other out. Now, presumably, since you're all Democrats, if you're elected to the Senate, that would no longer be the case. But would Minnesotans essentially have two Paul Wellstones in the Senate? In other words, are there any areas where you disagree with Senator Wellstone and would vote differently than he does? Let's begin with State Senator Jerry Jensich.
Is he here?
Yeah.
Where is he?
Oh,
that's as good a spot as any. I think Paul voted against DOMA, and I probably wouldn't do that. And my guess, he probably is 0.08 too, and I wouldn't do that. Those are the quickest two, probably.
Okay. Minneapolis Business Executive Rebecca Yanish. Any area where you would disagree with Paul Wellstone?
Well, I think it's more a matter of perspective here. When I come to financial issues, I kind of look to my education background, the degree in finance, the MBA, and really look also to my experience in owning a small business, what it feels like to me to payroll and to pay taxes. And I think I'd probably fiscally be a little bit more conservative than Paul is. Paul is certainly passionate on moving forward our social agendas, but I think I would probably be watching the dollar a little more carefully.
Mike Cerisi.
Well, we all have tremendous respect for Paul, and I do, obviously, also. But I would not be a second Paul Wellstone in the United States Senate. We would have disagreements, I'm sure. We come at the Senate from different positions, different backgrounds, different experience levels. Two specific areas, Jerry just mentioned one was DOMA, but I would have voted differently on DOMA, and the other one is on permanent normal trade relations with China. Paul has stated his position, and I have stated mine. But having said that, let me tell you, we'd have a great Minnesota twins when I'm elected, and we're both in the Senate together.
Former State Auditor Mark Gayton, any area of disagreement with Paul Wellstone?
Just one lucky was out of the room while the other three answered, and now he come back. I had to research this one. I found a couple months ago that the Senate was looking at the issue of testing for students, and Paul expressed very well, and I agree with him, his concern about how these tests sometimes discriminate against minority students and others with English with second language, the like. But as I recall, there was a vote in the Senate that would have prescribed to some extent what states could and could not, should and should not do with regard to testing, and I would not have supported that because I think with the limited federal government role in funding public education K-12 that it ought to also defer to the states and local governments the particulars, and having worked myself as state auditor and also as the state agencies, I have a good regard for the ability of state and local governments, generally speaking, to constructively manage their own affairs, and I'm concerned about the overlap of all of these regulations on the public and private sectors.
And one more question before we go back to our audience, if you'd allow me, please. The Congress currently is deadlocked again on the prescription drug issue. All of you say you're in favor of that, some kind of a prescription drug benefit. Democrats have been pushing for inclusion of a prescription drug benefit in the Medicare program. Republicans have been generally advocating a plan which would funnel a benefit through the private insurance industry. Republicans won't give in. Democrats won't give in. Apparently, there will be no prescription drug benefit again this year. If you were in the Senate right now, would you at least go along with the Republicans, since they're in the majority, give it a try for a couple of years and see if it works? Let's see. Jerry Janicich.
I believe that I would try, yeah. My dad is 82, my mom's 78. I would like to have them just experience it one time before they die.
Rebecca Yanish.
No, I believe the Republican approach is such in the wrong direction right now that it would be dangerous saying that's acceptable on a temporary basis. How would you ever change it? You would have a situation where we're subsidizing the insurance companies and expecting them to step up and do the right thing. Well, we've certainly seen right now what happens if you try that approach just as supplemental insurance to Medicare right now. 900,000 people under Medicare right now were dropped from private insurance coverage just this past summer. So how in the world can we rely on those private insurers to do the right thing for something as crucial as our prescription medication? The other part of it too, of course, is acknowledging the fact that the private insurers don't even want any part of that plan. But more importantly than anything is if we're trying to accomplish more affordable prescription medication under an understandable, comprehensive insurance program, if you're doing it through Medicare instead of through the private insurers, it also gives you clout on reducing those prices.
But so, in the meanwhile, nobody would get anything.
In the meanwhile, I think what you have to do is stand true and step up and say that's not the right approach for our seniors. That's a Band-Aid that isn't going to provide comprehensive care. And what we need to be doing is working hard, paying attention, and building the coalitions we need to make sure that every senior in the United States has access to affordable medication.
Mike Cerisi.
I would not agree to the Republican plan, but I would set the table differently and try to arrive at other types of compromises. Number one, I've stated very specifically what my plan is. It follows or parallels President Clinton's plan, but I would also put on the table that you could import drugs so long as they were FDA approved. I would reinstitute the ban on advertising. I would prohibit the practice of paying generic drug companies to keep lower-cost generics off the market, and this practice is being undertaken by branded drug companies. Once you start setting the table that way, the negotiations take place in a different way, and that's called leadership. That's what I would do. I would not agree to the Republican plan because I think it's unworkable for some of the reasons that Rebecca stated, because I do not believe it directs the discussion and negotiation in the direction it should go.
Mark Dayton.
I would not go along with the Republican proposal. This is why we have elections, so that the people can decide what the priorities and the directions will be for this country. First of all, with the Republican insurance policy, once again, the relatively better off can afford a better coverage than the people who need it the most, which are the elderly who are the most indigent, especially women, widows, who did not get properly credited for their work at home and whose spouses have deceased. And it's the worst situation to see these companies gouging these most vulnerable citizens in our society with their profiteering, and it's shameful that our government is doing nothing about it because of the Republican Congress, which is the second point, that the pharmaceutical industry desperately wants to keep the federal government out of providing a direct coverage through Medicare because they don't want the federal government in Washington doing what the Canadian government is doing, which is protecting their citizens, which is why seniors can go to Canada and get drug prices for half or even less than half the price of what they cost here in Minnesota and the United States. That's shameful, and that should be changed, and not only because it affects our seniors, but because we all pay those higher prices, and one in every four Americans does not have prescription drug coverage. And secondly, for those who are on public programs, taxpayers pay more because of these outrageous prices that are being charged. So across the board, we got to fundamentally change. The Republicans are just holding out to protect the pharmaceutical industry. Even the insurance industry doesn't want to take it on. That's why we need a Democratic majority in the United States Congress.
Jerry Janicich, did you want to say anything?
It seems to me the United States Senate passed some sort of a prescription drug piece this time around, not too long ago. And it seemed to me it had 80-some votes and it was bipartisan. And let me tell you what, we must not have learned too many lessons. We have a current governor who's there because a ton of people were very cynical about how government responded to them. We had these discussions in 1960 under President Kennedy. My dad was 42 years old. Today he's 82. And you know what? He still doesn't have the prescription drug piece. We still don't have health care for America. Sometimes being a leader is about getting stuff done. And make no mistake, as Democrats, if we want to beat Rod Graham's, we better not create cynicism with that group of people that voted for Ventura.
Michael Stracey, did you have more to say?
Well, I would just follow up on what Jerry's saying. I guess I disagree a little bit, Jerry. You have to set the table right, and that's leadership. Leadership is not agreeing to a plan that the Republicans propose that does not have any chance of success, that the insurance companies do not want and will not provide the coverage that people need. We need to take a look fundamentally at how drugs are priced in this country. American citizens are subsidizing foreign citizens because of price controls. Two-thirds of the drugs are developed in Minnesota, in the United States, and we are subsidizing the research and development on those drugs. We had a whole congressional hearings on that. And once you start setting that table differently, drug companies, and I know this from personal experience with them, react differently. And that's why I would not agree to the Republican program. And I think to just say you'd go in and agree to that, and I don't mean this as a criticism, and again, I'm not attacking you, Jerry, I'm just debating you, I just don't think that is the appropriate way to go, and I don't think that provides the leadership that we need. We as Democrats have a different program.
Jerry Janicich, briefly, and then I want to move on.
Okay, well, just a comment. I don't care that the insurance companies don't like it particularly. Public service is ultimately to accomplish something for the people you represent, no matter what. And when we get tied into some of this stuff, it's no wonder we end up where we are. Cynicism is about us engaging our government. And when we engage our government reacts. We don't engage our government enough. And until we engage our government and corporate America, it's not going to react to us. And we have to move off the dime.
Okay. You're listening to a live debate among the four major candidates for the DFL U.S. Senate nomination. Last debate before Tuesday's primary. One of these candidates will move on to the November general election against Republican incumbent Rod Grams. A couple of reminders, you can watch and listen to this debate on our website, MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. Also, if you missed part of tonight's debate or simply want to hear it again, it will be available on our website. And we're going to rebroadcast this debate in its entirety tomorrow on our midday program, 11 to 1. Back to the audience questions. Let's go back to the second floor of the Fitzgerald Theater, where D.J. Tice of the St. Paul Pioneer Press, our co-sponsor, standing by. D.J.
Right, Gary. I'm here with Scott Haynes from Eden Prairie, and he has a bit of a pop quiz for our candidates.
Well, I'd like to have a well-informed U.S. senator, and I want a U.S. senator that doesn't always have to rely on staff. So here are a few questions. What is the multilateral agreement on investment, and why has it not been ratified?
Wait a minute. Hold it. I'm going to have to write these down. All
okay.
Right. Lateral agreement on investment?
Multilateral agreement on investment. And
all
why
right.
has it not been ratified?
All right. You get one more question.
Oh, darn. I have two. They'll be small. What do you think about President-elect of Mexico's Vicente Fox's proposals to, over the long term, ease the movement of people across the Mexican U.S. border?
Okay.
The last one is, what do you know about East Timor's history over the last 30 years in U.S. action and inaction regarding East Timor?
Well, we could be here all night with these. just a couple of quick yes and no answers for these.
Yes.
Does anybody know anything about the multilateral investment treaty?
No.
Mark, Gary, this is Mark Dayton. You know, this is why George Bush once wanted to have his debate on Larry King. You see,
All right.
Now,
you stumped us, really. I beg your pardon on the East Timor question, but we could be here a long time discussing the roots of that dispute. But a quick comment on the Mexican president's proposal that 10 years down the road, you essentially open the border so people can go back and forth and you don't have guards on either side and all of that. Do you basically support that idea, Rebecca Yanish?
Well, yes, and actually, Gary is going to say, gee, if I can answer 2 out of 3, do I get extra credit?
This isn't school.
Well, when I look at the border issues, and as someone, again, who grew up only about 60 miles from the Canadian border, you know, I've really watched with interest how people move back and forth across our northern border and watch with dismay how people lose their life into crossing from Mexico to the United States. This is a real puzzle here. And part of the question I have when I look at it, is it because the people coming from Mexico, you know, look a little different or sound a little different? And, you know, to me, I think what we should be doing is working towards improving that connection with Mexico and making that boundary more fluid. And part of the way you do that also is working with the Mexican government to increase their level of living and just the humanitarian issues that are underway right now in Mexico. So not all residents there would need to come to the United States to find hope in their lives.
Anybody else care to comment? Gary Janicek?
Just close your eyes and think about how neat that would be. Mm-hmm. And think about how disappointed you have to be that we didn't make that statement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Michael Cerisi?
Well, there was just a report on the effect of deporting the undocumented workers in Minnesota, the effect that would have on the economy here. And so you can just project that across the nation as a whole. I would hope that we would move toward open borders with Mexico. So I support in principle the aspirations of President Fox. With regard to the multilateral agreement on investment, I don't know anything about it, and I would ask the questioner, maybe you can help me on this one, because I got stumped the other day on the federal unemployment tax and where that is going and how it's being used. So if you got an answer for that one, I'd like some help on that, too.
Perhaps we can discuss that after the program.
Yeah.
Mark Dayton?
I would not support it until we get our own situation straightened out here in the United States, because I'm told that on the one hand, we have a backlog with the INS of 4 million applications for visas of varying kinds. So we have a whole backlog of people who are trying to enter this country legally and are from all countries of the world and are being prevented from doing so while or held up. And at the same time, we have estimated some 15 million additional jobs in this country being held by immigrants, and one-third of them are reportedly here illegally. So we've got people who are trying to play by the rules who are being kept out of the country and people who aren't who are just allowed in. And I think we've got to straighten out that as a country and decide what our policies going to be and apply it equitably to countries like Mexico, but also countries that are all over the world who have citizens who are seeking to join relatives and others here. That's got to be the first step.
Web question has come in. Will Rhodes from Duluth, a member of the Northeastern Minnesotans for Wilderness, asks, do you support full wilderness protection for the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness, including phasing out all motor use in the future? Mark Dayton.
I support the compromise which Congressman Vento and Congressman Oberstar reached last year. It doesn't satisfy everybody on both extremes there, but it provides, I think, a workable solution, and one where with an area of over 2 million acres, I think everybody can enjoy it and still preserve its essential wilderness status for future generations of Americans.
Jerry Janicich.
I support the Oberstar-Vento agreement, and we as Democrats should let it go.
Rebecca Yanish.
Well, you can tell that we've rehearsed this many times in the past. You know, we've answered this question several times, and I've consistently said that I'm concerned about the level of motorization that was included in that compromise. However, I would have a hard time doing a total phase out of all motor vehicles.
Mike Cerisi.
I support the agreement of Representatives Vento and Oberstar.
It's back to the audience here at the Fitzgerald Theater, and Laura McCollum.
I'm here with Paulette Will of Minneapolis, who doesn't have a pop quiz, but you do have a foreign policy question.
Since the Senate is the only body that will be ratifying treaties, I'd like to know if you support the second round of expansion of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the first round having been Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic. Our two U.S. senators did not agree on that. And the countries that specifically are probably going to be under consideration in the next administration are Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Slovakia, and Slovenia. And secondly, do you believe that if this is expanded, if NATO expansion does take place, that it will threaten Russia, or that Russia will somehow or another cause international problems over that?
All right, second round of NATO expansion and what Russia's reaction might be. Who would like to go first? Anyone? Mike Cerisi?
I guess I'll take a stab at it. I am not yet in favor of the second round of NATO expansion. There are a number of issues after the breakup of the Soviet Union that I think need to be addressed. The Armenian question is one, and there are others. So I would go slow on the second round of NATO expansion, because I think from a geopolitical standpoint, there are many other issues that are inherent there that need to be addressed.
Jerry Janicich.
Yeah, I would move slow, but I would like to see the expansion happen. My family came from Slovenia, and I think that would be part of. I think that would be neat.
Rebecca Yanish.
Well, right now, certainly Russia has a lot more troubles on its plate, I think, than looking at threats from NATO expansion. We've certainly seen that in recent events in Russia. I would like to see the second round of expansion supported, but again, I think we do have to work towards that cautiously.
Mark Dayton?
I'd have to approach it cautiously as well. I think support it in concept, but not at the expense of our relationship with Russia or jeopardizing that relationship.
Mm-hmm. One of those unfair yes and no questions. The Senate's going to vote this week on the China trade bill, extending permanent normal trading relations to China. Would you vote yes or would you vote no?
No.
Jerry, that was Jerry Janicich. Rebecca Yanish?
I would vote yes with riders on human rights, labor, and environmental issues.
But without those, you'd vote no.
That's right.
Mike Cerisi?
Yes with 11B rider amendment. Without no.
Mark Dayton?
No.
Back to the audience here, Steve Dornfeld.
Gary, I've got Jerry Rasmussen from Shoreview who's got a question about health care.
My question is, I do believe we have universal health care right now. It's just that it's the rottenest system we could possibly have. And people come into our clinics and into our hospitals and into doctors' offices because they're ill and they've waited too long in some instances to get health care, so the cost has increased. And then they leave those facilities and they are unable to pay their bills. It's unfair to the system, and it's unfair to the patients. And I think if we were to look at those costs that have been incurred by all of us, we'd find out that we could, in fact, have universal health care for all of our citizens. And I would hope that you would each pledge to look into the fiscal aspects of that question.
Okay, any candidate response? Rebecca Yanish?
Thank you so much for bringing up that issue, Jerry, because just recently, actually last month, I toured the Hennepin County Medical Center, which is a safety net hospital and incurs a lot of the costs that you're talking about for the uninsured. And the administrator there who's giving me the tour talked about the fact that there's about, they pick up a cost of $30 million a year in terms of the treatment that they have to provide to the uninsured. What I thought was very interesting, though, in the tour that I had there with some of the doctors, is the doctor giving me the tour afterwards said, you know, 2 years ago I gave the same tour to Rod Grams. I said, is that right? He said, yes. And he said, you know, in the 45 minutes I spent here with you on this tour, I think you asked me about 50 questions. And then he said, that was 50 questions more than Senator Grams asked me during the tour.
Anyone else care to comment? Michael Strisi?
Rebecca, somehow that doesn't surprise me. Jerry, that is a very good question. We, at last count, I think, spent about $45 billion a year treating people in the emergency rooms of hospital, uninsured people, for illnesses and diseases that were preventable at the outset. So we're treating at the back end what we should be doing at the front end. And yes, we should look at that. And that is why I have the health plan that I have proposed and to phase it in incrementally so that we start focusing on preventive health care and we get people into the system.
Mark Dayton?
You know, we are one of only two industrialized countries in the world, the other being South Africa, who does not provide comprehensive health care to all of our citizens. And one of the consequences, as you asked in your question, is the fact that we have terrible financial inefficiencies as well as very inhumane inequalities. And as I've talked with Minnesota hospital administrators, some 10 to 15% of the people go into the hospitals do not have insurance. They tend to go into the emergency rooms for care that's more expensively provided there because they don't have primary physicians. They don't have preventative health care. And so the money that that those hospitals then have to make up results in higher premiums and higher taxes paid for the public program. So somebody pays for everybody's health care in this country. It's just whether it's done in a straightforward preventative way or whether it's done after the fact in a way that is destructive to people and inefficient to the economy. And I favor the former.
Jerry Janicich, care to comment?
Well, she's right, and we need to take a good hard look at how we spend the money. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it, and put it where it needs to be done.
Up to the balcony we go. Michael Koo, you have a questioner?
That's right, Gary. I'm here with Mikkel Beckman from Minneapolis, who has a question about how these political campaigns are paid for.
National politics is increasingly a millionaire's game, with over 80% of Congress being millionaires. And I was just wondering, for the three non-endorsed candidates, if you could just comment on, do you think you would be on this stage if you did not have the money that you have? And for all four of you, could you please comment on how we can prevent politics from becoming an activity of only the moneyed class? And you can include comments on campaign finance reform.
All right, let's ask the non-endorsed candidates first. Would you be here if you didn't have as much money as you do? Michael Cerisi?
No, start with me. All right. Well, they are very expensive. I can attest to that. Yes, I would be here. I would be here because of the record that I have established over 30 years as an advocate for the common good. And with regard to campaign finance reform, I believe Jerry and I are the only ones at the second preceding televised debate when we were asked whether or not we would support fully financed federal campaigns. He and I said yes. So we need to get at it. When I was considering getting into this race, I met with some senators in Washington who I know and sat down with them, and they said, Mike, we need you here because you can say no to the special interests. And it struck me what that said about how we are funding campaigns today. We have a continuous cycle in the House. Once they're elected, they're either paying off their debt or raising money for the next debt. Senators are at it constantly, if not for their campaign, for other campaigns. We have to find a way, constitutionally permissibly, to finance these campaigns. But there's other ways that our that candidates get help too. You know, and endorsed candidates get help, unions give help. So there's a lot of things we need to look at to make sure that everyone has an opportunity to run for public office.
Just a quick follow-up, Mike Cerisi. If we went to total public financing, would that eliminate the ability of people like yourselves to spend your own money on your campaign?
That's the constitutional issue, Gary, and that's what I would look at. And I think there are ways to get at that constitutionally. That's what I would prefer, that you do that. But there's other issues, too. I mean, you know, the unions have fought some. On the other side, businesses fought it. We've had both sides of the aisle fighting this. There have been very few senators who have stood up and said, let's address this from both sides of the aisle.
Mark Dayton, would you be here if you weren't a wealthy person?
Well, I would be here in the sense that I was endorsed by the DFL party in 1982 for the Senate. And so I would have continued to be involved in the DFL party, and I would like to believe that I could earn the opportunity to compete for the endorsement. I would not be here in the sense that I decided in 1997 that as I could not support all of the views of everybody in the DFL in process, and that I had fundamental disagreements with it that needed reform, and I was not well received for my critique. And I learned, looking at history, that heretics are excommunicated at best and executed at worst. They're never endorsed. But the larger issue...
So I get religious here.
The largest... The larger issue of should it be possible for anybody to run for public office in this country, absolutely yes. Is the American people being seriously disadvantaged by the system now, which is financed by wealthy candidates like myself who have an unfair advantage, and by the special interests out there who bankroll all the rest? The answer is they're being terribly served, and we need to build public understanding of that and public support. The only difference I have in terms of, you know, matter of degree in terms of complete full public financing for anybody who files for office is I don't think we should have 400 or 4,000 people up here because of that. I support a system of partial public financing very much along the lines of the Minnesota model for state offices, where candidates qualify by raising contributions from small contributors, and then on that basis there is public financing. That's also the one that's used before the presidential candidates.
Rebecca Yanish, would you be on the stage if you weren't relatively wealthy?
Well, as someone who was recently labeled the mini millionaire, this is the first time in my life I think I've ever been called a mini anything. But, you know, I am here, and the only reason I'm here is because of the help and support of 9,000 individuals who've written checks to help me. Yeah. And to me, that's a lot more important than talking about, you know, the personal wealth or what we bring to this race is really the grassroots support that's come forward to help me with my candidacy. But I'll tell you, I'm really intrigued here currently by the James Carville proposal for campaign finance reform, which is designed to break the real lock and the power of the incumbency. Carville talks about, preventing an incumbent from actually raising any money so that you no longer have the power of your chair position in the U.S. Senate. But what he says is you should allow the challenger to raise as much as they want and then have public fundings for 85% of whatever the challenger raises going towards the incumbent. I think that's very intriguing. You know, you really are looking at especially the disparity between the power of the incumbent right now. We all know Rod Grams. We've been watching his contributions from insurance companies, from pharmaceuticals, from oil interests, and we certainly see the impact on that in his positions right now. And if we can break that grid there, I think we'd go a long way towards having a stronger democracy.
Jerry Janicich, you are the endorsed candidate. What about campaign financing? Let me put it to you this way. Let me ask you this question. You have made a point through the campaign of mentioning that what the Senate doesn't need is another millionaire, that more normal people should be in the Senate, perhaps a bartender from Chisholm. And
perhaps.
That's about as normal as you can get.
Well,
here's debatable.
That's the case.
Here's my question for you, Senator. How important is this issue to you? In other words, if you don't win on Tuesday, the only candidate for the Senate who isn't going to be a millionaire is Rod Grams. Are you going to support him because he's not a millionaire?
Good gracious. I didn't sound facetious. Okay, it didn't sound facetious, Gary. It was facetious. This is a very core issue. Wake up, Minnesota. Wake up, America. Will I support Rod Grams? Not a chance. Not because he's, not only because of the money. This is about Rod Grams philosophically doesn't come close to representing me, my father, my mother, my brothers, my kids, my grandkids. Philosophically, he does not represent me. But let me tell you what, Minnesota, when I went to Washington, Torricelli, when I sat with Torricelli, he said, how much money do you have? That's what he asked. I said, I have a legislative career in the Minnesota House, in the Minnesota Senate, representing working men and women, and I have a ton of VFL values, and I proved it with legislation I have passed. Torricelli asked me, how much money do you have? After that. Think about that, Minnesota. Not only Minnesota, America. Think about that. This, who actually would I be running against right now as the VFL endorsed candidate? Mike said yes. Okay, that means there'd only be two of us. Realistically, Mike said yes straight up. All right, just a little while ago, Mark said he'll do this job for a dollar. Which Minnesotan can do any job for a dollar a year and live? We are taking away an opportunity for our youngest, our brightest to run for public office. We have to change this. I don't know what's going to happen to Jerry Janicich. It's not about Jerry Janicich. The rich should run. There's nothing the matter with that. But so should the poor.
Okay. Quick comment, Mike Cerisi.
Gary, I'm not done.
Well, briefly.
Ultimately,
here.
There's nothing brief about this issue.
Well,
this
Senator, issue, we have a lot Gary, of other issues to Gary, cover here.
I know. Gary, this issue hits home to America.
Well, that's true, but I want to get one
is,
comment
this,
here.
This issue. They're all good. I mean, I'm gonna. If I get beat on Tuesday, I've already told each one of them that I will bust for them. Okay. All right? I already have, right? Mm-hmm. I've already said that.
We all will, Jerry.
But I will watch to see who takes that bite of the apple, and if they don't get it done, I guarantee you I will be here again. Okay, because that has to change for every child in this country.
Okay. Quick comment, Mike Cerisi, and we'll move along here.
But Jerry, you know that I've taken on causes all my life, and our backgrounds, where we came from, isn't much different. My father had a seventh grade education. His parents were immigrants. The problem I've had with the tenor of your debate, not with the substance of your policy, because I'm with it 100%, and you know that, is that as Democrats, we have somehow taken the position that if you've achieved financial success, you somehow left your values behind. You're no longer worthy of running for public office. We're going to tell our children they should succeed, but not succeed too well. The fact is, for working people in the United States Senate, four senators have the highest grades. Three are millionaires. One is Paul Wellstone. The others are Cole, Kennedy, and Rockefeller. The fact is, Franklin Roosevelt did more for poor people in this country than anyone he had inherited wealth. The fact is, the Kennedy family not only gave their lives, they also did much for the poor people in this country, and you know that, Jerry. So we have to get away from talking about what type of financial success people have and what's the content of their character. And Michael, I'm with you 100% on campaign finance.
Michael, ultimately,
Gary, very brief comment here.
I thought we were debating. Ultimately, the teacher who teaches my kids is pretty successful. How do they run for public office? The individual who wires my home is pretty successful. How do they run for public office? The plumber, pretty successful. How do they run for public office? You know why Jerry Janusz gets to run for public office? Because he was a state senator who had a political base, and he used the endorsement process.
Okay. DJ Tice, question up there in the second, on the balcony, please.
Right, Gary, I'm here with Steve, a community college student from Minneapolis, with a question about public schools.
What is your position on public school prayer in student-led prayer?
Okay. Student-led prayer in the public schools, should that be permitted, Rebecca Yanish?
Well, I believe that private prayer is appropriate, but I do not believe in having prayers in the classroom, and I think that the recent Supreme Court ruling on that, it should be certainly supported. Prayer does not necessarily belong in our public schools.
Anybody else care to comment? Jerry Janusz?
Yeah, I can remember as a kid, every time the teacher passed out the test, I prayed.
I'm not for prayer in school.
Mark Dayton, Mike Cerisi, care to comment?
That gives a new meaning to student-led prayer, doesn't it?
This is Mark Dayton.
I do not support public school prayer. The separation of church and state is just fundamental to this country. I'm religious. I believe most Americans can choose to do so, but that's a different matter in their own home or synagogue or church from public school.
Okay, Mike Cerisi.
I do not support it for all the reasons that you find inherent in the cases that have dealt with that issue at the Supreme Court level. You find that some people of different faiths are intimidated into actions that they otherwise would not take. So I'm opposed to it.
Laura McCollum, question from the audience here.
Paula Maccabee of St. Paul has a question, and I should note that you're wearing a Mike Cerisi t-shirt.
The question is for all the candidates. I'm a mother of three and an environmental activist, and I'd like to hear from each of the candidates, why would you be the strongest advocate for clean air, clean water, clean food, and the preservation of our national forests?
Okay, and I know we could all speak for a long time on this subject too, but if we could keep our responses relatively short, we're just about out of time here. Who would like to start? Jerry Janusz?
This past legislative session, the environmental community came to me and asked me to carry their legacy initiative, which was all about clean water, clean air. And when I had asked them, and I didn't get the endorsement, Mike got the endorsement from the Sierra Club, I didn't get that, and I went and I screened for it. I asked them, why me? And they said, because in the legislative process, you get things done. Well, we came out of this legislative session with the most money in environmental and wastewater, clean water, RIM, Minnesota River, than we had in a long, long time.
Rebecca Yanish?
Well, Paul, on the issues that you listed there, certainly I'm passionate about preservation of our natural areas, but also have a proven track record in remediating the effects of irresponsible corporate behavior that we find in our inner cities and also in small communities all across the state. And I think it's important as a U.S. Senator to stand up and say we must correct the contamination that's happened in the past, in addition to continuing to protect the water, the air, the environment in the future.
Mark Dayton?
Because I have been in the forefront of these battles in Minnesota for the last couple decades. I founded the Minnesota Project in 1979, which has been involved in strong environmental causes throughout the state for the last 20 years. When I was on the board of the Environmental Quality Board as Commissioner of Energy and Economic Development in the early 80s, I opposed NSP's attempt to transport nuclear waste from Monticello to Prairie Island via trains going through Minneapolis and St. Paul. Was able to block it the first time. Unfortunately, the industry lobbyists successfully rammed it through the next time. I was involved in jawboning the energy companies, oil suppliers, Coach, Amoco, and the like, to clean up their messes, and also was architected the pipeline safety law in Minnesota in the 80s, which forced them to dig deeper trenches to put people's safety ahead of profits. And for that, the energy companies and the utilities joined up with the Republicans in the Minnesota House to try to gut the energy division of my department in 1985 and destroy the entire agency in 1986, which fortunately the Democrats in the Senate and Governor Perpich opposed and deadlocked the session, went home. I worked with the Prairie Island activists to oppose NSP's nuclear storage proposal, and I also worked with the feedlot activists in 1997 legislative session to stop the steamrolling over local governments to prevent these atrocious feedlots. That's where I met Julie Jansen, who became my running mate in 1998. I made that one of the centerpieces of my campaign then, to stop these huge agribusinesses from putting these football-sized field 10-foot deep lagoons, cesspools with all this waste and sewage, which is threatening our water supply. And I'll go out in Washington and fight until we clean those up in Minnesota and America, or Julie Jansen will have my hide.
All right. And Mike Cerisi? Well, I got about a minute here before.
I didn't think you were going to come up for air there, Mark. Well, first and foremost, because I have the Sierra Club's endorsement, and they spent at least 2 hours with each of us screening us and trying to understand whether we understood the issues, and I'm very proud to have their endorsement. Secondly, because I have affected the public good, not just in this state, but in this nation and the world, starting with the Bhopal case, where right-to-know laws with regard to chemicals that are in plants in your neighborhoods, you have a right to know, and we established a theory of multinational enterprise, holding companies responsible, absolutely liable for chemical spills and emissions. Because I've taken on ARCO, Exxon, Shell, Texaco, and in clean air cases, and I can go on and on and on, I have fought the battles in the arena and affected the public good by changing companies' conduct for the betterment of our clean air, clean water.
Okay. Well, we are... Unfortunately, we're just about out of time here, but we do want to give each candidate one more minute to make a last pitch for your vote. The primary is on Tuesday, so 1 minute closing statements, and might as well do it in alphabetical order again. Michael Cerisi.
Thank you very much, Gary, and thank you, NPR and the St. Paul Pioneer Press, my favorite home paper. Let me...
right up there on my list, too.
Yeah, exactly. Let me state that I am proud to have the endorsements of 20 papers, including the Minneapolis Tribune, the Duluth News, and 18 other papers across this state. They spent time with us, their editorial boards, much more time than an average citizen can. They looked at our temperament, our knowledge, our ability, and as the Minneapolis Tribune said, I would be a formidable advocate, a powerful advocate for the common good. That is what I've done for 30 years. Minnesota deserves leadership in the United States Senate. I will provide that leadership as I have provided it in the past in taking on special interests and affecting the common good in a positive way.
That was Michael Cerisi. And up next, Mark Gayton. Mark, go ahead, please.
1975, I had the opportunity to go to Washington and work for a truly dedicated Minnesota Senator, Walter Mondale, and saw what a public servant really committed to working on behalf of people could do on behalf of this state. I also saw what a critical difference it makes who is in the majority and controls the United States Senate.
The last few years, I've witnessed that in reverse in terms of the Republicans and what they've tried to do to reverse the values of this country, and also seeing what one man of great conscience, Paul Wellstone, the best United States Senator in America today, could do on behalf of Minnesota and people all over this country. And I think Paul needs some help and some support. Even though we come from different backgrounds, we share very similar beliefs. We're both activists. We believe that government should work on behalf of the people. And if I go to Washington, I will not only be a voice, I will be a fighter on behalf of the causes that I've championed throughout this campaign, that I've worked for on behalf of my career in public service, and I ask you for your support.
Okay. That was former State Auditor Mark Dayton. And next up, State Senator Jerry Janicich.
I'm Jerry Janicich, the DFL-endorsed candidate for the United States Senate. The first question we were asked was why we thought we were the best Democrat. That party has my endorsement. That party has spent more time with me than any paper, no, any editorial board. Ultimately, it's not about Tuesday. Ultimately, it's about who beats Rod Grams. And ultimately, I want you to think about that. Because to get there, we have to send somebody who is going to make sure that they pick off some of that Ventura vote. And I want you to think about that. I want you to think about his political base, Grams' political base, and who takes it away from him. The suburbs in Anoka. Some of the 8th where we lost the last time.
Okay, Senator.
And I believe, ultimately, this is about Tuesday, and ultimately, it's about winning and beating Rod Grams.
All right, that's Jerry Janicich. And finally, Rebecca Yanish.
Yes. Thank you, Gary. So I, too, am proud of the endorsements I've received in this process from newspapers in all corners of the state, and especially the strong endorsement from the St. Paul Pioneer Press. Talking about... Yes, thank you. They pointed out again that I would bring a fresh new leadership and a strong new voice on many of the issues that Minnesotans care about across our state. And Jerry, yes, there is a good point here too. In looking at the contrast to Rod Grams, and as pointed out by the Pioneer Press, they believed that I bring the strongest contrast to Senator Grams and the best opportunity to defeat Mr. Grams in November. So I am looking forward to bringing that strong new voice, representing the interests of all Minnesotans on the issues they're passionate about: education, health care, affordable housing, farm policy, and more safety in our schools and homes for our children. Thank you very much.
Thank you all. Well, that concludes this last debate before Tuesday's primary election for major DFL candidates for the U.S. Senate. I'd like to thank the St. Paul Pioneer Press for co-sponsoring this evening's debate. Thanks to all of you here in the theater and those of you at home for joining us. Again, thanks to the candidates. Good luck to all of you. One reminder, if you missed part of tonight's debate or would like to simply hear it again, check out our website.